The rider faces me as if the rest of the battle, the flames streaking across the sky, the smoke billowing from the ships below and merging with fog above, the screams of crossbowmen and the thuds of cannons unleashed, as if none of that exists. It's just the two of us and our dragons. And then Ixion charges.
Griff. She's got it in her. For a heartbeat that contains a lifetime of futile hopes, of fantasies that have clouded my vision between waking and dreams for as long as I've been Sparkus and he mine, I realize she'll be able to do it. She'll best Ixion. She's agile, precise, vicious. And she doesn't have a damned muzzle on her dragon's jaw. She will end him. I am frozen. The smoke and the fog and the burning island below for a moment lost to me as the future glares bright. Ixion must feel the threat hanging too from how he begins to banter. Very good, he says, concentrating your targets on dragonborn strongholds. Unfortunately, we decided we wanted to keep some of our peasants safe. Very safe. Inside our halls. Antigone Sir Aela freezes. I can see the understanding course through her dragon. I've never in my life felt such a clench of love for a stranger as I feel in this moment for this miracle of a girl. Ixion presses his advantage. So your plan to spare them, he says, that would be backfiring, wouldn't it? Her guard is open as she stalls. Ixion sees it, and Nita tenses to spring. And a skyfish, coming out of nowhere, tackles them. Antigone's wing rider, throwing himself between her and Ixion. The same one, I realize, from that scouting mission.
Duck!
Antigone shrieks. The skyfish weighs so little, Ixion's Sir Nita could hurl it from his path, and for a moment I expect him to. But then Ixion pauses, his helmet cocked at an angle I know from years of experience to witness with dread. Ixion, noticing a weak link in his opponent's armor. And instead of shoving the wing rider aside, he reorients Nita. Hold her off, he tells me, while I take duck. I hear myself stammer.
My lord.
Do it, he says in Norish. And then you can go find your brats.
Annie. Griff holds me like a brick wall, heedless of the fire that Aela and I begin to hurl at him, as if he can't feel it, as if his storm scourge doesn't care that Ayla's talons are piercing his wings and her fangs are slicing into his armor. All we can think, the single thought filling our two minds as one, get to duck, get to duck, get to duck. But Griff's momentum is too great, and with every beat of his Storm Scourge's wings, he pushes us back. Away from them. Away from the dragonfire whose heat I can feel blazing in bursts between duck and Ixion. But I can see them. I see Ixion's Storm Scourge claw its way onto Serta's back like a mounting bear. See Duck and Serta thrash beneath the weight. See the Storm Scourge begin to gnaw at what I think, at first, is Serta's wing until I realize. It's her saddle girth. The strap that holds Duck in his saddle to her back. And then I begin to scream. We are level with the lowest stratus, the fog mingling with tendrils of smoke. The citadel so far below that the screaming coming from its buildings and ramparts is muffled and distant. Aela is sputtering, running out. But I can't stop her firing because her firing and my screaming are the same. The girth is in shreds. It begins to slide sideways and Duck slides with it. The skirmishes of dragonfire, lighting the sky, seem to still around us. For all I've screamed, no one has heard us. No one has come. I can hear Duck yelling, and then I hear him yelling my name. So I begin to plead with the brick wall. Griff, please! Kalish, then Dragon Tongue, then Norish. And at that point, Griff lets out a noise like he's choking. And I realize what he's choking in his own language back to me. I'm sorry. The girth tears. Duck begins to slide. Serta begins to shriek. And we watch the fall.
Griff. There is a moment longer of struggling. While I hold her back, and Ixion keeps the dragon from diving after its rider. I don't hear it the moment of contact. We're too high, too far for the sound to reach us. Higher than the day Mabalena's family was dropped. The skyfish feels it. She lets out a shriek that sends pain straight to my bones, even as the hair on my neck goes on end. At the sound of the skyfish's widow cry, Antigone's pleas fall silent. She goes limp in the saddle. Her struggling stops. Ixion releases the little skyfish, and still shrieking, it dives headfirst for the ground. Too late. Too far. Too silent. And the rooftop of the great lord's hall cracks, and the fires billow, and into those flames the skyfish dives. Antigone sits frozen on her dragon like the sight has taken the air from her lungs. Her opening is wide, but I don't fire. Below us, the ships burn. Around us, dragons from my side and hers are sputtering as their dragon fire runs out. And from the island that is my home, smoke rises. My body is searing with burns from Antigone's Aurelian. Sparker rasps from her scratches and bites. Somewhere among those blaze sites, the little ones need me. Please, I tell Antigone Sir Ayla, my voice breaking. Go.
17. Losses. Lee. I wait with Palor at the head of the defensive team, scanning the horizon from the ramparts of Fort Arran. The edge of Sailor's Folly is barely visible, mere stubble against the horizon as the sun rises. Closer to shore, I can make out Starved Rock, the site of the Pythians' first attack on Callipolis. The first snow of winter begins mid-morning, dusting the ramparts, lowering the light, limiting the horizon to a grey blur, which means, in the sky, rime ice. I try to imagine what is happening over New Pythos, and can't. What remains real? Annie's face, pale beneath freckles, telling me to stay behind. Me not arguing it. Because since the night of the Lyceum riot, I've been certain of only one thing about this regime. I'm done fighting for it. And while that doesn't mean I want my family back, it doesn't mean I'm ready to take up dragonfire against them, either. Julia was enough. Julia was a mistake. That's the terrible thing I keep wondering. The terrible spiraling fear as I stare out over the horizon waiting for my friends to return from a battle with my family. Was all of this a mistake? Choosing Atreus over my father, Annie over Julia. And with that wonder, the thought of the way forward presented in that moonlit half-dug bunker when Megara smiled and offered her hand. A city roiling with hunger. You make a good speech. There is only one war I still want to fight, and it's behind me, in the city, waiting for my return. Beside me, on the ramparts, Palor growls and paws the snow, his snorts billowing steam. Full of a frustration for battle, that I cannot, despite every reason I should, share. With such poor visibility, it's impossible to make a count of riders trickling in off the horizon. I'm going down the rows, identifying wing riders returning one by one, when Power Sur Eater emerges from the whirling snow and skids across the ramparts. Power dismounts and makes his way toward me in a single motion as he tears off his helmet. Annie lost Duck! For a moment, I think he means, literally, means she can't find him. And then I realize that Power isn't smirking, isn't scowling, isn't looking at me with any of the hostility that has been shared between us for 10 years. He looks frightened. The hair on the back of my neck goes on end. Annie lost Duck. Power is saying something, talking about Cor coming and find Annie. But I don't hear him because I'm trying to understand. What? He fell. Power lifts an arm and drops it. And all my protesting questions come to a slamming halt at the illustration. From how high? Power shakes his head. He fell into a blaze site. Surta followed him and didn't come out. And I wasn't there to do anything. I feel my spiraling doubts come to a halt like they've hit a brick wall. Power looks past me, squinting into the snowstorm. His brows are frosted with ice. There she is. I'd know Antigone's Sur Aela by their silhouette alone, even in a world bleached of color. Power and I move as one toward them, to the rime-frosted figure sliding off the saddle. There are shouts in the storm, medics helping riders off saddles, dragons whimpering from cold while the snow blows. Annie's armor is blackened along the side, across the shoulder, and smells of burnt leather. But she doesn't seem to notice. Her hair, when she removes her helmet, is frozen in spikes at her neck. I need to find Cor, she says. Power catches her. Lee will take care of Cor. You need to get medical attention. Inside. She pushes past him like she can't hear him. And then her brown eyes, which strain unseeing, find me. She tilts her head up, reporting to me like I remember her doing when we were children in the play yard. Who hurt you? Tell me what happened. Ixion did it. When he realized I was scared for Duck, he had his squire hold me off. I feel a chill that has nothing to do with the cold. Power has frozen behind her, poised to take her by the shoulder. I need to find Cor, she says again. Annie and I first knew each other in states of grief. But I've never seen her like this. The fresh thing, the sleepwalking shock. I register this even as I realize it's happening to me too, feel it taking over, turning my movements automatic. Automatic and attuned to one goal, protect Annie. Behind her, Power is shaking his head violently, his eyes wide as they seek my own. I know Cor too well not to understand what he's getting at. Annie shouldn't be let within 20 feet of Cor, not right now. I'll handle Cor. You need to go with Power. Power takes her shoulder. Let's get inside, he says again, and find the medic. He turns back to me as she lets herself be steered away and adds in a low voice, behind you. I turn to find Cor. It's clear from his face that he already knows. His visor is up and his eyes strain past me, searching. For what or whom, I'm not sure. I saw it happen, he says. I couldn't get there in time. When he realizes I'm holding him, preparing to keep him back, he turns to face me. His face is black with ash and his voice raw from smoke. She was supposed to keep him safe. No, I want to tell him. I was. And I didn't. I was here doubting my choices with Julia. staring at the horizon and imagining green scarves and protests at home, while Duck was out there dying, and Annie was watching it happen. And I was here doing nothing. This is what happens when I sit it out. This is what happens when I let Annie decide the flame shock is too crippling because I don't like how it feels to fire and remember Julia. What happens is people I love pay the price.
Griff. Snow begins, the only mercy of this day, as we fly back to the Citadel. Pumps used to empty the mines at high tide are being strung across the island, turning fires to wet smoke, and the falling snow sizzles and spits as it smothers what the pumps can't reach. There's so much smoke I can't begin to make out the damage. In the lairs, I unsaddle Sparker and Neater with fingers shaking in haste, and I'm already turning to go when Ixion speaks. You're not done yet. Numbly, I follow him up to the armory and help him disarm, trying to block the memory of the Kallipolan First Riders weeping as I fight panic. Becca. Garrett. I need to find Becca and Garrett. The room is full of subdued grunts of pain. Only two of the Storm Scourge bastards have returned so far. Nolan, visibly burned, is disarming them with sharp breaths, hastening, as I am. We both have family to find. Once the bastards leave, Nolan takes off at a limping run from the room. Ixion lets me continue unbuckling his armor until my words trip out in silence. My lord, please, do you know what building they were? My voice cracks. This time, Ixion doesn't pretend to wonder whom I mean. I haven't the faintest idea. With an air of disinterest, he reaches for a scroll lying on the table beside him. This might tell us. Manifests of the shelters provided to the Norseans during the attack. He passes the scroll to me without glancing at it. I look down as if hoping that, in my desperation, the meaningless scribbles will turn into something I can make sense of. They don't. Ixion is watching me, smiling. The door bursts open and Faemy Skyfish comes in, covered in ash and looking distempered. Well, that was a disaster, she tells Ixion. Then she notices me, standing in front of him, clutching a scroll, and makes a noise of impatience. For the love of the dragon, Ixion, give it to me, Griff. I pass her the scroll and she unrolls it. Who? She asks me. Garrett and Becca Aemon's daughter. Faemy nods, scans further, and then grimaces. They were in the Great Lord's Hall, she says. The Great Lord's Hall. The blaze site into which that boy Duck fell, that swallowed his little dragon whole. I don't wait for a dismissal. I run.
Annie. Down in the makeshift medical bay in the converted mess hall of Fort Aaron, Power leads me to one of the cots stretched out among the other riders, already receiving attention. He helps the medic find and treat burns that I observe on my own body without feeling when we peel back my flame suit and underlayers. Power's words are muffled, like he's shouting at me from a distance, and I respond slowly. I have trouble remembering the sentence that came before. The surroundings come into focus gradually. Deirdre, on the cot next to mine, weeping. And then I realize what she's saying. I couldn't get to him in time. Some awful peasant rider tore him apart. She lost Max. I've watched them spar together daily for as many years as I've sparred with Lee. Deirdre's never held the difference of our backgrounds against me. She's always used the right language so carefully. But she lets the word peasant slip without even noticing, and utters it with a hatred that freezes my blood. I look around the room for the first time, taking it in. My riders, my friends gathered. Some on cots receiving treatment, others there at their sides, and all in grief. And then there's Cor. He's standing two cots away, and his words cut through the haze like a knife.
He could have stayed behind.
Lee's there too, seizing Cor's arm.
Cor, stop it.
Cor wrenches free of Lee's grasp and takes a step toward me.
He should have stayed with Lee. You were supposed to keep him safe.
That's enough, Lee shouts.
He seizes Cor and slams him back against the cot. Cor responds to the wrestle like an embrace. He chokes and Lee shifts, cradling him as the choking turns to something else. Lee wraps an arm around him, muffling the noise as Cor breaks down and twists to look over his shoulder. Not at me, at Power. Like he's cueing him. I don't even realize until I look down that Power's arm is around me too, and that I'm shaking.
Let's go somewhere quieter, Power says, and work on that report for Holmes.
Sitting next to a spitting fire in a darkened hall of Fort Aaron, he, Rock, and I numbly go over the numbers. Corroborating ships sunk and buildings bombarded and riders down and injured. All the while, I'm replaying the moment where I made the decision that Duck wouldn't go in Lee's group because Serta had sparked. Duck was underperforming, but I assumed my fears were disproportionate, my judgment clouded. If I had just written his name on a different list, I should have put him in Lee's group.
No, Annie, Rock murmurs, gripping my knee. None of that.
Rock, who flew in Cor's group, provides an account of the maritime airstrikes in lieu of Cor. He is quiet, unharmed himself, but on edge. His storm scourge, Bast, was clipped from a cannon to his wing, and Rock feels it. Since he learned of our casualties, he keeps rubbing at his eyes. I lapse into silence while he and Power finalize the report, the numbers washing over me, Cor's words replaying.
You were supposed to keep him safe.
In a dark council room, the winter storm winds whistling outside, Power, Rock, and I relay our report to General Holmes and the other members of the War Council present at Fort Aaron to oversee the expedition. We give them the numbers. 12 ships burned, 1/2 the citadel and 3 manors afire, at least 4 Pythian riders down with status unknown. 3 of our riders lost. Orla, from enemy dragonfire. Max, who did not survive a mauling from a muzzled dragon, and the numbers. Holmes describes them as an overall success. It takes me a moment to understand what he means. I've pleased him. I've come home with 3 riders dead and more wounded, and Cor unable to look at me and Duck gone. And Holmes is telling me I did a good job. Mission accomplished. No, not a good job. Not an overall success. Suddenly I'm determined to convince Holmes it wasn't. They had Norsians locked in the Dragonborn strongholds, I tell him. They couldn't get out. This wasn't a part of the report Rock and Power prepped with me. Rock's pale face goes a shade whiter, under the unscrubbed ash as he looks up from his notes.
How do you know that?
Ixion told me, right before Ayla ran out. Rock is probably the only guardian who could begin to share the depth of my horror. But that's little comfort. He lowers his head into his hands as his great shoulders begin to shake.
I bombarded those sites. I bombarded.
If I were someone else, some better commander, I'd put my hand on his shoulder right now. But I sit frozen, inches from him, watching him break down. My lips offer numb comfort. You are following orders. My orders. Holmes's voice is curt.
Who was locked in the strongholds isn't strategically relevant. What's relevant is that we hobbled the Pythians before a long cold winter and will make them think twice before attacking us again.
Rock's fingers clutch the short spikes of his blonde hair.
I'll admit, I am a little disappointed at our losses, however, Holmes adds. They were greater than anticipated.
Losses. Deirdre weeping for Max. Cor, his voice raw, telling me I was supposed to keep his brother safe. Duck falling. Losses. I answer the unasked question. We were unprepared for significant aggression from the muzzled riders. Lucian Orthos, the young chief of staff who once questioned my stomach to bombard Norsian peasants, has been watching our report quietly from Holmes's side. He speaks for the first time, his voice soft and insinuating.
The muzzled riders whom you gave orders to show mercy to?
I have no idea how he heard. Yes. Holmes lifts a hand to hold off Lucian.
Did you issue a countermand to that order?
He asks quietly. Countermand? In the air, with only bugles and horns to communicate. In the confusion of battle. But the truth of the matter is that it didn't even occur to me. My silence is its own answer. Lucian Orthos is smirking like I've just proved all his prejudices right, and I find I can't summon up the energy to care.
From now on, Holmes tells me, and his voice has gone deadly calm. No more distinguishing. If it's got the Pythian sigil, you fire on it.
Through the numbness of my own horror, I hear myself answer.
Understood, sir.
But he's not finished.
I don't care if it's Norsian, muzzled, chained. If it's wearing Pythian armor, it's a target. You want to fraternize with peasants? You go find them in whatever village they rustled you out of, and you fraternize with those. But the ones in New Pythos are our enemy, just like their lords. And from now on, that's our policy.
Beside me, Power stirs, unnerved by Holmes's sudden vulgarity. Even Lucian Orthos looks too startled to be gratified. I have a brief, flashing memory of that moment when Griff Garrison raised his visor and said, "Above you." But that's the last thing Holmes wants to hear. And with Duck gone, because Griff held me back, I don't want to think about it either.
Griff. I can't find them. Not in the ruined hall, not in the smoking citadel, nowhere in the streets where I run calling their names. I can't find them, and that means only one thing. I was the one who brought news of Aemon to Aga 2 years ago. I remember the walk, preparing the words, the way her knees gave out when I said them. The little ones were so little then. I remember telling her she wouldn't be alone. Now I won't even be able to say that. My poor sister, who weeps quietly in the night when she thinks I can't hear, who always smiles for her children in the morning. How am I to tell her that they, too? My steps grow more and more leaden at the approach. The thought that before I come home will be before, and when I cross the threshold and she sees my face, will be after. A skyfish is curled in the alleyway outside our home, still in battle armor. And then I realize that our door is open. Within, the house is so bright, every candle must be lit. And silhouetted in the doorframe is a single, tall, skinny figure, whose brown face and curly crop of hair I'd know from the other end of the earth. I fall across the threshold. Becca and Garrett are in Aga's arms, unharmed. Aga is laughing and weeping as she holds them, and Granda is holding her. Garrett is saying, "We got to fly a dragon, twice!" And Dilo is there, in his armor, covered in ash, explaining in his careful Norish that he would have come sooner except that he had to get the other Norseans down into the crypt. Then he turns and sees me. "Griff," he rasps. Surrounded by my laughing, weeping family, in this glowing room, I suddenly feel that Dilo and I are alone. I drop to my knees and press my lips to the side of his boot. Above me, Dilo inhales a shuddering breath, and he sounds for all the world as though it causes him pain. "Griff," he says weakly. "Griff, get up." But I don't rise. I croak out the answer I was trained as a child to say, the language of my people, not his, because it is in Norish that these professions belong. "May my lord accept the gratitude of his servant for mercy undeserving." Dilo bends. He crouches to my height so that we are both on our knees on the floor. And then he murmurs a single word against my ear. "Enough." His face is next to mine, forehead beside forehead. I don't dare lift my face for him to see it, wet, to see what it looks like to have lost dignity past even the desire for it. He murmurs my name, and then his hand finds mine on the hard-packed dirt floor. Something cool, metal, is pressed into my hand. Slowly I uncurl my fingers and look at what he has given me. Sparker's key. "I had it copied before I gave it to Ixion," Dilo murmurs. "But it wasn't until I saw what happened today that I..." Our heads are still close, crouched together. Dilo reaches trembling fingers up, touches me beneath my chin, and at the slight pressure I lift my face at last to look at him. We are inches apart. I can see every fleck of his irises, and his next words warm me with their breath. Dilo's voice shakes as if the words frighten him. "Do what you need to do."
Annie. Night has fallen by the time the meeting with Holmes concludes. The corridors of the fort are dark, narrow, and drafty. I stop on the winding stair as the last of my energy drains from me. And power stops too. "Where's Lee?" I hear my own voice waver. I can feel it looming, the wave of grief that's about to crash. And the only thing I can think, as I feel it approaching, is that I need Lee. I want a mother to hold me, a father to comfort me, but I don't have those. I have him. Power blinks at the question. I think he's still with Kor. You just sat there. You could have saved him. Of course. I can't have Lee. Kor has Lee. But I will not do this on a drafty stairwell of Fort Arryn with power holding my arm. Ayla? I manage. Okay.
Power says. He leads me back up to the ramparts. The storm has calmed, the snow collected in drifts. Where the dragons curl together, warmed, wet stone radiates, snowless. I find her among the Aurelians, Palor's wing tucked over her like a blanket. When she sees me, she rustles, opening her own wing, rumbling a purr, inviting me into the crook under it, where I will be alone. I turn to Power. I think I need...
Yeah,
I get it. He's already backing away. What are you going to do? Power rubs his face.
Might take Eta out. Circle the harbor a few times. Try to clear my head.
I don't remember until after he's walked away that I should have thanked him. It's a tent of warmth under Ayla's wing. The starless sky overhead is all I can see. The smooth scales of her side all I feel. The rise and fall of her breathing the only thing I hear. But then my vision fills with dragonfire. Dragonfire on peasants my orders burned. Duck smiling this morning when I kissed his cheek. Duck slipping sideways as he cried my name. I crawl out from beneath Ayla's wings. She unfolds herself. And then she follows me as I climb. I half run up the stairs leading to the tower roof, the highest vantage point of Fort Arryn, which looks out over the harbour, and the moonlit North Sea, and the jagged peaks of the highlands spreading west. We're alone. A small, dark silhouette of a single dragon crosses the night sky far overhead. Power Sir Eta seeking their escape in the vastness. I inhale the cold air, so sharp it burns my lungs, wrap my arm around Ayla's neck, and for the first time, in a very long time, I imagine a different life. If I hadn't been chosen, hadn't been taken to the city and lived as I would have, somewhere deep in the highlands, before I had ever known Ayla, or the Guardians, or this weight, I wish I could become nothing again.
Griff, we sleep together in the back room for warmth, but until tonight I've never thought of it as a luxury. Aga and I curl around the little ones. Grandar lies on their other side, and as they tell the story of their adventure, Aga rises over and over again to kiss their hair until they complain and tell her to stop. They talk of Ixion's dragon and sheltering in the Great Lord's Hall with the other Norsian children, and the fire that began, and the smoke that filled, and the doors that wouldn't open. They're so matter-of-fact about that point, hardly noticing how Aga's hand covers her mouth, and she has to bury her face into the blanket for a moment to muffle a scream. I take her hand and her nails dig into mine. And then their story goes on. Dilo came, bursting open the bolted doors, helping the peasant children down into the crypt, and then calling Becca's and Garrett's names specifically. They took particular satisfaction in this. And then we got to ride a dragon again, Garrett thrills. They transform from storytelling to a dead sleep mid-sentence. In the sudden silence of their lengthened breathing and Grandad's gentle snores, Aga rolls onto her back. What did Dilo say to you? I think of the way my skin thrummed when he touched my chin with the tips of his fingers, when we looked at each other. I've held a dragonborn's gaze like that before, but never, never once with Julia did I feel so strongly that we saw each other. He said, enough. Enough. I don't know if I mean it to stop her question or to answer it, I have the secret against my breast, the metal of Sparker's key warmed to the temperature of my body. And long after Aga falls asleep, long after the room is full of nothing but the sound of her breathing, the little ones, my sister, my grandfather, I lie awake, clutching it, the possibilities blinking like stars in the darkness before my eyes. Do what you need to do. Dilo didn't define it for me, so I must. And after tonight, I don't have to think twice to know what it will be. We fight for lords who lock our children in burning strongholds, while the enemy spares our thatched roofs. I'm done playing for New Pythos. It's time I played for someone else. Antigone. Dilo just gave me the only thing he could. Sparker. One dragon. Just one dragon. Not enough to change the tide of the Kallipolans' war. Not enough to do anything more than get my family killed. I might be skilled in the air, but what has that skill ever been except a mockery of my powerlessness on the ground, where I'm relegated to delivering letters and unlacing the first rider's boots, unable to so much as read my family's names? When I finally see it, I rise in the darkness as if I've been summoned. I make my way through the dark village with soft footsteps in the snow. At the gates of the citadel, I make the same excuse I made for years on trysts with Julia. I've been summoned to Stormscourge quarters. And the guards remember the excuse and don't question it. Then, inside the walls, I look up at the skeleton of the ruined Great Lord's Hall and remember my crimes. The little First Rider, who tried so hard to spare us. And in return, I held her back while Ixion took her friend. Even if I want to turn, she'll never have me. Not after that. I find my feet taking me into the hall. Rubble that was the roof before the blaze litters the ground, slick with ice and snow. At the back of the husk of a hall lies a crater of shattered rubble, and in the center of it, the snow-covered mound of the boy's fallen dragon. I approach, dust the snow from the dragon's closed eyes. She's long cold. I search the snow around her until I find what I dread and desire in equal measure. The remains of a dragon rider's armor. A few tempered dragon scales from a bit of the cuirass that survived the blast. All that remains. And suddenly, holding these, a different purpose comes to me. Let the First Rider take me or not. She returned a body to us, and I will return these remains, pitiful as they are, to her. The only atonement I can offer for my crimes, the only thanks I can give for her mercy. Let me answer her honor with honor, where they think we have none. The true gift of freedom is to act with this civility. What's come over me? This bout of high-minded ideals. I make my way down to the lairs. Sparker rouses, seeing me, tail flicking in the darkness. The lairs are deserted, the dragon sleeping for the night. The snow brings with it assurance of safety and a lowered guard. Dragons unable to spark from the cold. No attacks from their side or from ours. I reach up for his collar and slide the key in. For the first time in my life, I free Sparker from his chain. I've no flame suit, but I don't need one. I've no saddle, no bridle, nothing. It doesn't matter. He emerges, and for a moment, the thrill of it, him and me together without our lords, dances in my blood. And then I clamber onto my dragon's bare back and kick off the ground. New Pythos falls away. The night sky fills my vision and thighs burning against Sparker's scales, arms numbing with cold through my tunic and trousers. We head south, racing the clock of this madness. We give a wide berth to turret and thorn rose, the karst pillars most often used by our sentries to keep watch, and we take to the cloud cover over Wayfarer's Arch, just in case. Not another Pythian dragon in sight. The sky is ours. And yet, as the decision grows cold, As the karst pillars fade behind us, but Kallipolin shores have not yet grown in the horizon, I feel the first sharp spikes of doubt. They'll find out. They'll drop them one by one. And after what you did today, the Kallipolins will fire on you on sight. Is this really worth the risk of everything? A bit of burnt armor in your pocket? But I hold steady, clutch Sparker like my life depends on it, and eventually the dark line of the great island arises. Kallipolis. The winking lights of the town surrounding Fort Arran, a harbor beside it, and above them a single circling storm scourge. I'd forgotten all thought of a parley flag until this moment. With fingers numb from cold, I pull my own shirt over my head. In the moonlight, it's close enough to white, and wave it as I approach. The storm scourge has frozen in place where it coasts on the wind. As we level off, I see the other riders only in a flame suit. No armor, no helmet. And his face is familiar. The rider with the shaved head and Dilo's brown complexion, who gave me Julia's body at the first meeting. "You," he says. I'm gripping Sparker's flank so tightly with my knees, my skin sears where it's not numb. I raise both hands over my head and call across the wind. "I need to speak to your first rider."
Annie. Ayla notices before I do, the second rider approaching Powyser Eater from the north. Another storm scourge. Her tail lifts. Her breath becomes a whining growl. Even at a distance, I know which storm scourge it is. But instead of facing off, the two pause only long enough for a short conversation before both turning back for Fort Arran. What is going on? Minutes later, Powyser Eater alights on the tower ramparts beside me, and in front of me, a second storm scourge lands. From it descends Griff Garrison. No flame suit, no armor. He is shivering, barely dressed. What seems to be his own shirt wadded in one fist. His dragon, its maw ever muzzled, crouches beside him with a wing half mantling him. Ayla's hackles are raised in a growl, her breath rattling into an inhale, as if attempting to fire despite the cold. Garrison's boots touch the ground, and he lowers to his knees. Kneeling, he holds something out to me, a lumpy, shiny thing.
"Forgive me."
It's a piece of duck's cuirass.
Griff. For a moment, I think the first rider will have her dragon attack us anyway. And then, instead, she lowers her arm. The Aurelian stands down, though her glare remains fixed on Sparker, her horns raised. Sparker glares back. They both have talon marks to show from their fight this morning. I give Sparker's ankle a kick, and the low hum of his growling stops. Antigone reaches up to her neck, unfastens her mantle, and crosses the snow to put it over my shivering shoulders. The boy's armor remains on my open palms in the snow. Antigone turns to her friend. Kalish sounds like Norish, but wrong. And I recognize the sense of it. "Leave us." He looks unconvinced. "Annie." She repeats herself with added emphasis. The rider gives a scowl worthy of Ixion, but he kicks his storm scourge into a launch all the same. Alone on the tower, Antigone crouches before me and takes the remains of the armor into her own hands. She holds them, looking down at them, her face in shadow. "I'm so sorry." Her fingers flick discreetly to her eyes. She speaks in her crisply accented dragon tongue. It's precise and slightly stilted, as if she's reading from a book. "Is your family safe?" I nod. "They were locked in, but they got out before..." I break off. What am I doing? I've no place telling her of loved ones who survived while she holds the remains of hers. But Antigone's mind seems to be shuttling in a different direction. My family was locked in once too. So that's why she wanted so much to spare peasants. It was good of you, I tell her, targeting so carefully, sparing Norcians. Antigone shudders as if I've reminded her of a horror. It backfired, as Ixion pointed out, and in any case, after our losses, it won't be permitted again. I'm sorry, Griff. She rises, holding Duck's armor lightly in her hands as if she were cradling a dead bird. Thank you for bringing these remains back to me. I realize that she means this as a farewell and lurch to my feet. Let me help you. Antigone, half turning away, goes still. She rotates on her heel.
What?
I reach up, touch the chain of Sparker's key, and then I take a breath. I'm Ixion Stormscourge's squire. I'm with him all the time. I serve him at table. I attend him in his private quarters. I'm privy to his most privileged conversations, and I have access to all of his correspondence. I can give you the information to help you bring them down. Only, I stop here, because this part is humiliating and mad, and most likely to make her give me up in scorn or disgust. Antigone's eyes are fixed on my face, searching.
Only,
she prompts. Only, it would help if I could read.
Annie. Griff's dragon tongue is fluid, easy, like Lee's the few times I've heard him speak his mother tongue, barely accented. His voice is a growl, hoarse from a day of inhaling smoke. His square face, his bald fists, convey a determination that, if not exactly proud, is fierce. I don't hate him, though I should. I see too much of myself in him to hate him. I know the taste of the kind of desperation that would drive me to do anything, commit any atrocity in the world, to save my family from the flames. But work with him? Now, after what happened? It was what I hoped for from the beginning. Now it seems foolhardy and wrong. He's the one who stood between me and Duck. He's the one I failed to get past when my friend needed me. He's the reason I'll never see Duck again. A hoarse apology and a bit of charred cuirass in my hands won't change that. And that's all there is to it, until he says this. Doesn't quite ask me, as if that's too shameful. But I hear it. Teach me to read. Amid everything that has happened, dragonfire and families and friends facing death, Griff Garrison wishes he could read. Of all the ways I felt my heart be broken today, this was not one I expected. They gave you a dragon, I think. But they wouldn't give you this. When I fail at first to answer, Griff keeps talking.
I can get out nights. We could meet, practice in secret. They wouldn't know I was gone.
He sounds desperate. Like bringing down new Pythos is something he wants, but reading is something he needs, from deep inside his gut, and hasn't been allowed to have. And of course he hasn't. Why would this have changed? When my father couldn't, my mother couldn't, no one in my village could. And surely in Griff's case, it would be especially convenient that he can't. Because he is primed to bring new Pythos down. But then I look at him, and think of Duck, and can't. But perhaps Griff knows that,
because he doesn't make me say yes or no tonight. Instead, he places one arm on his hulking Storm Scourge's back and lifts the other to point down the coast, toward the blackness of the Kallipolan lowlands. Then he names a place, a date, and a time. Midnight, on the driftless dunes, half a week from now.
"We'll be waiting for you," he says.
18. The Island of the Dead. Annie. I wake to memories of a strange dream. A night where I met with Griff Garrison and watched Duck die. And then I remember, it wasn't a dream at all. I think for a moment that my body won't move from the bed. I'm in the mess hall, converted to a trauma ward, on a cot I must have stumbled into last night. Others are stirring. I can hear them. And I can feel it. A sudden, unnatural weight. The first rider's medal still pinned to the uniform that I fell asleep in. A wave of self-hatred rolls over me, forcing me to my feet. Then I do the things that need to be done. As if doing my duty today can undo yesterday. I force down porridge, confirm an agenda with Holmes. The riders and dragons fit enough for flight will return today to Kallipolis, while those in critical care will stay here longer to convalesce and prepare my things. In contrast to last night, when the medical ward seemed to burst, to explode with noises of pain and grief, this morning it is deadly quiet. Rock eating porridge at Lotus's cot side. Alexa shaking Deirdre awake. Lee, on the far side of the room, packing with Cor. And then there's Power, standing in front of me, rubbing sleep from his eye with the palm of a hand.
"So what did you say to him?" he asks.
I tear my eyes from Lee and stuff down the ache of wanting him to look at me.
"Who?"
Power jerks a finger north. "Garrison." That part I might still have believed to be a dream. "I'll tell you later." I organize a formation that we studied in textbooks but never drilled for the return flight. A funereal. Two by two, with the fallen riders borne by their closest comrades bringing up the rear. We pass over the snow-bleached countryside headed south. Orla is borne by Lotus Sir Eustace. Max is borne by Deirdre Sir Rhea. Their widowed dragons drift behind us, trailing their riders' remains. Duck Sarserta's cuirass is tucked inside my uniform, warm against my skin. And though I know it deserves to be held by Cor, I don't know how to tell him how I got it. So I don't give it to him. Lee and I lead the cavalcade in silence. This grief, I think, it's like a dirty house I abandoned that even years later I know how to crawl through blind. Was there the same guilt then? That presses weight against my chest and makes it a conscious effort to breathe. Another round of snow has begun, this one to accumulate by the feet rather than the inches. The dragons are sleepy, sluggish. They don't hibernate fully, but they slow in winter. Which will mean, from now on, less drilling, fewer patrols, and no airstrikes. From our side or from theirs. A seasonal, forced ceasefire with the dragons unable to spark for the cold. And during that ceasefire, life will go back to what it once was. We'll attend our classes, do our homework,
go on rounds. We'll do all the things we used to do, with people missing. I wait for Lee to come to me. He doesn't. I wonder if maybe he wasn't just holding Cor back when Cor said those things. Maybe he agreed with him. I don't blame him.
Lee. The bodies lie in state, guarded by their widowed dragons, and the keepers tend their cuts and burns. I make a trip to the infirmary to tell Krissa what happened. She listens without interruption, weeping silently while I speak. Though I don't fill in the spaces of emotions, she guesses it. You're all blaming yourselves. You, Annie, Cor. I swallow, suddenly unable to answer, my imagination going one more time to what might have happened had I been fit for battle, been there to do something. I see the three we lost everywhere. In empty seats at refectory tables, in empty beds in the dorm, in the silences in the solarium that they would have filled. Duck was never my closest friend, but he was always a part of things, at Annie's elbow, in Cor's shadow, laughing, smiling, even when he was scared. Duck lit up the room. Krissa says, "It wasn't your fault, Lee." I nod, words failing, and I wonder for the 100th time why Annie hasn't come. On the morning of the funeral, I'm sitting at my desk with legs propped on it, not so much as an open book to excuse my inertia, when Alexa comes to tell me that Annie has locked herself in the girls' washroom. "Did she ask for me?" "No," says Alexa. "Then what do you expect me to do about it?" Alexa gives me a hard look. "Don't act like this isn't your territory, Lee." An Albans reference? An orphaning reference? In almost any other context, I wouldn't give the time of day to poorly fired assumptions about a past others have no business reminding me of. Today, it feels like the summons I've been waiting for. Damn right this is my territory. I vault to my feet and follow Alexa to the girls' dorm. Inside, Deirdre is half-dressed in ceremonial armor, hammering on the washroom door and calling Annie's name. Orla's bed has been stripped, her uniform folded at the foot of her bed to be returned to her parents at the ceremony. I move between Deirdre and the door. "Can you use another washroom?" "Our things are in there." "Yeah, well, guardians aren't allowed possessions." Deirdre glares at me. Alexa takes her arm. "Come on, Deirdre," she murmurs. When they're gone, I rap twice on the door, a single knuckle. "It's me." She doesn't answer. "Annie, if you don't say anything, I'm going to break the door." Ear pressed against the door, I hear a single whimper. I lower my shoulder, brace against the door, and shove. The bolt is old and rusted. It snaps open. I stumble over the threshold, imbalanced, to find Annie crouched in the center of a filled bath, curled in on herself, her face pressed against her knees like she's hoping if she presses hard enough, she'll compress into nothing. The bumps of her spine burn smoothed, poke from her back. The bath water is still steaming. All at once, the missing her, the needing her, becomes too much, and I don't care anymore why she hasn't come. I close the door behind us, kick off my shoes, strip down to my underlayers, and climb into the bath beside her. She doesn't even ask what I'm doing, just unfolds enough to crawl into my arms. She curls into me, the same way she always used to do. And even though we kissed little more than a month ago, I know that this is different. I keep my eyes on the top of her damp head and my arms around her waist and shins. Mindful, too, of burns. "You're here," she says. Like she wants me to be. "I'm here." She curls closer, and I think, even if we were never to kiss again, even if it were never more than this, it would be enough just to hold you. I can't do this, she murmurs. The funeral? The job. I can feel a burning in my throat moving up to my eyes. I tilt my head to stare at the ceiling, willing it to cool. You're good at this job. Annie shakes her head like she's pushing away a thought, and then she breathes. Good at choosing which of my friends die. My own guilt croaks out. Better than sitting it out in cowardice. The water lapping the sides of the tub, the droplets dripping from her hair, echo in the empty washroom. That night at the Lyceum, the morning at Fort Aaron, both, I realize, were moments when I did nothing. And maybe I disagree with Annie about what something should have looked like, but I know after Fort Aaron that nothing can't be the answer. I can't sit on the bench anymore. She presses her forehead against my chest, lowering her face to the water so that her hair spills like seaweed around her head, and speaks into the wet strands. Cor had asked me to let him stay in your group. I've been bracing myself for mention of Duck since I slipped into the water beside her, bracing for her blame as I deserve. It's only now that I realize she's been too busy blaming herself. Of course, that's why she hasn't come. My group was for unsparked riders. He was underperforming. It's not your fault. Annie lets out a dull moan, like this is a line from a circle of reasoning she's trapped in. Do you want to know the funny thing? She murmurs. The funny thing is, I think he thought he was protecting me. She is laughing, and as it turns to tears, I pull her to me. Well, that was pretty stupid of him. Annie lets out a drunken-sounding snort that she smothers against my chest. You can't say that about people who are... And then she starts crying, hard. I hold her until the bath gets cold. Though there's no attempt at modesty under the water, we turn away from each other to dress. She's drying her hair when a knock sounds on the door, and the person who lets himself in isn't Deirdre or Alexa, but Cor. He doesn't question what I'm doing here, or even seem to notice me. Pale,